Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now.
Today, we're going to take Cole Porter's advice and brush up our Shakespeare. The timing of our show is based on the fact that this weekend, the Carlos Museum at Emory University is putting on display a rare and precious manuscript, a Shakespeare First Folio. It's the centerpiece of an exhibition called First Folio, the Book That Gave Us Shakespeare. It's mounted by the Folger Library in Washington, D.C. The exhibition has been touring each of the 50 states, and Emory was chosen as the site where Georgians could see it. We're going to start today with a conversation with the co-director of the First Folio tour, Sheila Cavanaugh. Dr. Cavanaugh is a professor of English at Emory and is the founding director of the World Shakespeare Project, which you'll hear more about in our conversation. Later, we'll talk to two theater veterans about performing Shakespeare. But first, Sheila Cavanaugh. Sheila Cavanaugh, thanks for being here for Two-Way Street. So let's start with some definitions. First of all, what is a folio?
Folio is the size of the paper. It's how many times it's folded over. So the modern equivalent might be the difference between legal size notepaper and 8.5 by 11. So folios are big and they are massive books.
Because the paper's only folded once,
right,
in a
exactly.
folio, correct?
Exactly. And in what was known as quarto, it would be folded 4 times. Octavo, it would be 8 times.
So that's a folio. Mm-hmm. The first folio means what?
Shakespeare died in 1616. And back in those times, people didn't put a lot of energy and effort, if you were a playwright, into publication. And a couple of his colleagues, Hemmings and Condell, decided in 1623 that they wanted to preserve Shakespeare's works for all time. And there's 18 plays, including some pretty heavy hitters like Taming of the Shrew and Macbeth, that would not now exist if the first folio had not been put together. So 18 out of all the plays that Shakespeare wrote and had performed didn't exist without the first folio. They would have been lost.
So unlike today, if I go see a Broadway show, the chances are good I could go to a bookstore, the dramatist bookstore, say, in New York, and buy the script for the show that I just seen. But when Measure for Measure, As You Like It, were first appearing on stage in London, there would be no script available any time afterward for a long time, yes?
Typically, no. Sometimes people would steal the scripts, people in the audience or other theater companies would. But the way that people made money was in performance. So there was a disincentive to actually having texts available because that meant that other people could perform them. And so many of the plays existed in what they used to call foul papers, bad copies, things like that. But for many of the plays, we didn't get complete scripts until the first folio, and not even then, actually. There's some of the plays, like Macbeth, for example, that we're pretty sure that we don't have the text of Macbeth as it was performed, but we wouldn't have it at all if it wasn't for the first folio.
All right, you've said a lot that we can unpack. Among other things, Shakespeare is known to have written at least 30 plays, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Does the first folio include all of the plays that we think Shakespeare wrote?
No, it includes most of the plays that we think Shakespeare wrote, or the ones that still exist. There are plays that don't exist at all.
Yes.
And not all of his plays were, but there were some that were printed as quartos. Famously, the Hamlet quarto is quite different than the folio.
Why?
There's different lines, different speeches. Some of the famous speeches, for example, To Be or Not to Be, comes out very differently in the quarto. And a number of plays change dramatically by the time they appear in the folio.
So that leads to another clear question for me, which is, What was the source for the plays that were printed in the first folio? How were they collected? How were they gathered?
We don't necessarily know how they were all pulled together, but we do know that Hemings and Condell worked closely with Shakespeare and presumably had access to texts and worked very hard to pull them together. There were, though, one of the things I think a lot of people don't realize is that there were intellectual property issues even in the 1600s.
Really?
And so when the first folio was put together, it wasn't clear that they could get the rights to all of the plays. And so there are some of the differences between the first folio and the second folio, and the differences between different versions of the first folio come because of intellectual property issues that got resolved.
I understand, certainly, there are plays that we never saw before. Beyond that, what are the other things about the first folio that are important to you as a scholar of Shakespeare?
The thing that's fascinating to me about the first folio is that they are each different. They're as different as the proverbial snowflake or fingerprint. So that when the Durham first folio that was stolen was brought to the Folger Shakespeare Library a few years ago, the person who had brought it in, I think, had no idea that first folios are so unique that they can absolutely be identified. And we can track things like what the compositors, which are the people who put the text together, we can track who the compositors were, changes that they made, updates that they made. It gives us an insight into the plays, not necessarily how they were performed, because these were years, again, after Shakespeare died, but it does give us a very early record of some important material about the plays.
The Durham folio, which was stolen, is there a mystery there?
It was, I believe, on America's Most Wanted. It was stolen. The man who took it was convicted and died in prison.
Where was it?
Where
had it been stolen from?
It was stolen from Durham in the north of England. And he had defaced it, thinking that he could keep it from being recognized. And he showed up at the Folger saying that he had bought it in Cuba and that he wanted to have it verified. The Folger, of course, knew that the story of buying a first folio in Cuba was suspect, to say the least, and they were able to convince him to leave it with them overnight in order to, they said to him, to verify it. But when he arrived to pick it up, the FBI were waiting for him.
Wow. How much would a first folio have cost if I wanted to buy it from a seller back when they were first published?
Back when they were first published, they were actually fairly reasonable. One of the things, though, you would have bought it without a cover. You would have bought the pages, and you would have taken it out and gotten it bound. It would have been expensive, much more expensive. You could go to the theater for a penny. So buying the first folio was pricier than that. But now it would cost you several million dollars.
There were thousands printed?
There were about 750, and there's about 250, they believe, that are left. As I say, the Folger has by far the largest collection.
In your capacity, you've been able to go to the Folger Library and actually leaf through a first folio, which we should say right away, clearly visitors to the exhibition at the Carlos Museum will not be able to do. What's the process? What's the procedure when you sit down, when they bring you the folio?
They actually bring you to the folio. The folios are only accessible if there is a reason why you need to see it. And only certain people at the Folger have keys to the vault. Either the head of the reading room or the head of the library will take you down to the vault. But they certainly don't leave you alone with a first folio. And certainly those of us who work with books from this period spend a lot of time being trained in how to handle books, the books have to be propped up. They've got special containers for the books. As I say, there'll be a librarian there monitoring and assisting, and one is very, very careful.
So, but as you touch the pages of a first folio, you're coming closer to Shakespeare than at any other time, I would think, in your work as a scholar.
No, I think that that's true. It is very exciting, which is why we're so excited to have the first folio at Emory, and we're going to have a first, second, and third, and fourth folio at Emory.
What are the most surprising things to you about looking at Shakespeare in a folio?
What I think is really interesting about Shakespeare texts generally is how different they are. Again, for example, in Hamlet, one of the famous lines is about this solid flesh. But in some versions, it's sullied flesh.
So,
those are different
words.
This
too solid flesh should melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. But you're saying another interpretation?
There are versions that spell it differently, where it's S-U-L-L-I-E-D.
Oh, that this too sullied flesh?
Yes. And different plays have moments like that, sometimes considerably. We have radically different versions of King Lear, so that when the Oxford Shakespeare was published a number of years ago, they published both versions rather than trying to somehow bring them together.
Are these textual or story differences?
Both.
Could you help us with that? So King Lear, we know the story of the three daughters.
The story is much the same, but that there are lines that different characters have. Sometimes in versions, you will have characters whose names change, like Falstaff, the famous character who was originally named Oldcastle. Much Ado About Nothing. There is a ghost character, we could call her Inogen, who is presumably Hero's mother. She appears in the cast of characters, but then she never appears in the play. Sometimes, as I say, lines are different. We do know that, for Macbeth, that there are lines in Macbeth, particularly those associated with the witches, that Thomas Middleton wrote. And
who was Thomas Middleton?
Thomas Middleton was another playwright at the time, and Shakespeare and Middleton worked together. Middleton was a very prominent playwright, but there are lines that are performed today that people are pretty sure Shakespeare didn't write.
You don't mean that it might not have been Shakespeare, but Middleton who wrote Bubble, Bubble, Toil and Trouble, the most famous.
I think that was Shakespeare, but some of the other lines were Middleton, and he had a play about called The Witch. And so there are all of these differences, and the first folio help bring those differences to light, where scholars can look and really try to get a sense of what is going on here. And Shakespeare's ambiguity is what I love about it. And I think the fact that we don't have a definitive, every copy of Shakespeare is the same, is what's exciting.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Sheila Cavanaugh about Shakespeare and the First Folio exhibition, now open at the Carlos Museum at Emory University. This is Two-Way Street. Back to our conversation with Sheila Cavanaugh. She's the co-director of First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare. It's an exhibition that's just opened at the Carlos Museum at Emory University. Dr. Cavanaugh also heads up an organization dedicated to spreading Shakespeare to people around the world.
As director of the World Shakespeare Project, I'm working with faculty and students and artists in on every continent. And there are issues in Shakespeare that are relevant regardless of the culture. Maybe not universal. I'm not going to claim that Shakespeare is the same to all people everywhere, but certainly issues everyone has: marriage and death and spirituality and the supernatural and politics and jealousy and revenge. And Shakespeare's plays are not straightforward, so that it's just as in real life, you can't always tell the good people from the not so good people. And you can't always tell whether your instance of love at first sight is a good idea or not. things like that. I just think that there's a richness, but it's also the ambiguity.
The World Shakespeare Project, which is your baby.
Yes.
I went to your website. And when you talk about the universality of Shakespeare, I saw two things particularly that stood out for me. One of them was a Polish prison where the inmates got to perform Midsummer Night's Dream. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
There is actually a huge Shakespeare in prison movement, shall we say. And we've currently at Emory got artist books that were created by prisoners at Phillips State Prison in Buford, Georgia, in their Shakespeare class. They're on display now at Emory. There's a lot of Shakespeare in prison work being done, as you said, in Poland. It's being done in Australia, across the United States, in India, in Northern Ireland. Shakespeare in prison work, I think, is one of the most exciting things that's going on.
Why Shakespeare in prison?
I think, again, because Shakespeare raises a lot of pertinent issues. When you're dealing with Macbeth, for example, many of these incarcerated students are serving time for murder. They've got an insight into what drives someone to murder in a way that most of the Emory undergraduates don't.
And of course, Macbeth is one of
exactly.
the darkest of Shakespeare's plays, blood everywhere.
Exactly, exactly. There's also a lot in Shakespeare's plays looking at issues like redemption and forgiveness and when those things are appropriate. And the other part about Shakespeare, what I found is that different prison populations, sometimes the incarcerated populations are highly intelligent and very literate. And other times they have very weak school backgrounds. But Shakespeare gives them access to the same texts that their more privileged counterparts are experiencing.
We're going to post on the Two-Way Street website the video of the Polish prisoners performing Midsummer Night's Dream. And I want to tell our listeners in advance, what I looked for is in the interviews with the prisoners who performed the play, one of them is wearing a fairy dress, a man, I presume playing Titania, perhaps.
Probably.
And it's one of the most startling and wonderful images I've seen, because here's this kind of rough-looking prisoner wearing a tutu-like costume. It said more to me in that one image than I could have talked about for 20 minutes.
Well, and it raises an interesting question, because with the different Shakespeare in prison programs out there, there are many, not all, are working with male prisoners. And depending on the program, Kurt Tofflin, who famously started Shakespeare Behind Bars, the men in those programs do play women's parts.
Yeah.
There are prisons where they bring in women to play the women's parts, and there are prisons where men absolutely will not.
Well, I was fascinated by the fact that this particular inmate, we don't know what he's in prison for, but there was no self-consciousness at all. He was perfectly comfortable looking into the camera with his tutu on and talking about Shakespeare. That was really fascinating. So Shakespeare himself, you know, we've talked about the universality of many of his the motivations and passions of his characters, the stories and how they reach us. The language, though, is what it really comes down to, doesn't it? The language is, to this day, extraordinary in ways that are unimaginable to think about one man writing.
I think that that's true. I think the language is extraordinary, but there's more than just the language. I think that the stories are also extraordinary.
Sure.
I just got back from Italy, where I was co-producing an opera of Midsummer Night's Dream with the International Opera Theater. The costumes were designed by a studio for artists with Down syndrome. And they designed the costumes. The designs were sent to Philadelphia, and then they were created from those students' designs. Those students clearly don't have access to Shakespeare's language in the same way that other people might, but the plays are still vivid and alive. The same, we've got some people coming who work with the Hunter Heartbeat Method, which is Shakespeare for students with autism. It's also incredibly successful. So yes, Shakespeare's language is extraordinary and there's nothing like it. And his plays are vivid and alive, even in other kinds of formats.
Help me understand, how do we as parents help our children discover Shakespeare? Shakespeare is daunting. Shakespeare can be formidable, right?
I actually would disagree with you
really?
On that. When it comes as speaking as a parent and as an educator, I think that kids often don't know they're supposed to be scared. A lot of times the children instinctively understand. They know about jealousy. They know about love. They know about anger. And if people haven't told them that they're supposed to be scared of Shakespeare, they aren't necessarily. And so I think that taking advantage, there's a lot of things out there for children with Shakespeare that are very successful. And I think that's a lot of it, is that the stories are so compelling that the children understand.
Harold Bloom,
uh-huh.
Shakespeare and the Invention of the Human, wrote his book and proposed a theory. It's a very controversial one, and you may not subscribe to it either, but it is fascinating. Because what Harold Bloom says to us is that Shakespeare didn't just write characters. He essentially created the psychologies that actually were modeled in civilization past that. It does strike me that Shakespeare did create in many ways our understanding of human beings in an earlier time than we had any right to expect. Is that fair?
I think that part is fair. Whether or not Harold Bloom is accurate is a whole another matter. But I do think that there's a depth of character that, which is, again, one of the reasons why we still go to Shakespeare. There are some other writers from the time who are wonderful. Ben Jonson, for example. But Volpone, which is a wonderful play, I see Volpone once every 5 years, and that's fine. I see some of Shakespeare's plays 6 or 7 or 8 times a year and get something new out of it, because there is such depth to the characterizations and there are nuances that come out when you see it from different perspectives that his contemporaries would be hard-pressed to have matched.
We should point out that Ben Jonson, certainly a rival, nevertheless, said essentially that Shakespeare was beyond compare, even in their time.
Was for all time, yes, exactly.
The first folio will be on display at the Carlos Museum at Emory University through December 11th. Dr. Kavanaugh is also overseeing a series of lectures, readings, and programs for young people that will take place on the Emory campus while the folio is on display. We posted information about all of that on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. We'll take a break right now. When we come back, we'll talk about staging and performing Shakespeare. Welcome Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. The first folio is about Shakespeare on the page. Now we're going to talk about Shakespeare on the stage with two theater veterans who've both done a lot of the Bard's work. Actress Rachel Harker has worked off-Broadway and in regional theaters around the country and has a long list of credentials in film and television. She is a veteran of many productions of Shakespeare's plays. Her husband is stage director Rick Lombardo. He's the chair of the Department of Theater at Kennesaw State University, but was also artistic director of the prestigious San Jose Repertory Theater and Boston's New Rep. Right now, Rick is preparing two shows for off-Broadway runs in early 2017. His work directing Shakespeare has been celebrated by critics in cities across the country. I started our conversation with Rachel. Tell me, as an actress, do you have to have a different skill set to do Shakespeare than most of the other theater work you do? Or is it all the same thing?
And I think there definitely has to be a different skill set because you have to approach it in a different way because it's not realistic. You're not going to be sitting there throughout the rehearsal process talking about motivation and intention and all of the backstories and relationships. So when you come to Shakespeare, you know, he just gives it all to you, but you really have to know how to look at it. So
what about the language?
Oh, the language is like the most amazing stuff.
But do you need to bring a certain skill set to being able?
It's energy for me. I mean, everybody has different skill sets they bring, and some just come naturally. They don't even think about it. But for me, one of the things in working Shakespeare is you have to have so much more energy than just about anybody else. Because it's all about the words, and the way it's written just propels, and you have to just keep going and pushing, and even when it's quiet, you have to be so focused and so on top of every moment.
Rick, you've both performed and directed Shakespeare. Let me ask you essentially the same question. Is there a different set of skills involved for a director when you approach Shakespeare?
I don't think it's the same set of skills at all. And I don't think my approach as a director can possibly be the same approach as working on a realistic play. You know, in the realistic play, we go through the rehearsal process, and as Rachel said, we talk about subtext and backstory, character development. We spend time where the actors can maybe paraphrase the text until they learn it. Very often it's what we're also rehearsing what they're thinking, what the inner monologue of the character is. Working on Shakespeare, I find, is a completely different process. Spend much more time just sitting around the table, analyzing text, defining words, trying to understand why Shakespeare chose these sounds, the onomatopoeia that's going on in the poetry, what is the rhythm of the language, also literally what does everything mean? You know, we are dealing with a writer who lives in a very different time. So he and his audience had a shared understanding of the world and of their culture. What did it mean to be a king? What does it mean to be a lord? What does it mean? What is man's relationship to the heavens? What is our relationship to God? These are some of the big questions in the play. His audience would come with an understanding. So I often find that we need to spend an enormous amount of time in rehearsal talking about Renaissance ideas, Elizabethan worldview, so that we can understand how to retell this story and recreate a production that will speak in similar ways to a modern audience that's going to come in with a very different set of expectations.
All right, so Rachel, here's a question that I'm sure you as an actor get asked a lot when you're doing Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to learn those lines?
It's actually easier than a lot of other.
Why?
Because of the way it's written. There's the meter. So there's a certain rhythm to it. And it's one of those where when you don't get the line exactly right, you can feel it. You can feel it in your body. Because once you've learned it and worked on it, it has that rhythm going on and it has that poetry. And if it's not right, you can feel it. So it's easier.
You have a text in front of you, and you're going to read for us in a few minutes.
Right.
But are there a couple lines in there that express that rhythm in a way, that meter in a way that you're describing?
a kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. You know, you can't like add an extra sound there. It's not going to flow the right way.
Right, right.
Doing Shakespeare, isn't it like there's a river? I always think of it like a river. And you get on the river and you cannot deviate. The river is just going to take you. And, you know, the iambic pentameter keeps leading you forward, one thought to the next thought to the next thought. What I often tell my students when I'm teaching Shakespearean acting is that we need to remember that Shakespeare stands at the very summit of the entire history of Western oral tradition, oral storytelling. The printing press, very soon, because books begin to come into people's homes and we begin to read stories, we start to learn both the skill of how to speak and tell stories, but also the skill of how to listen and tell stories, because reading changes the way our mind works. But Shakespeare is the last, at least in the English language and in Western tradition, he is the last great storyteller that purely is using thousands and thousands of years of learned techniques for keeping an audience enwrapped with a story.
I want to ask each of you for a favorite. Is there a favorite Shakespeare play for you, Rick?
Yeah, well, you know, I tend to be a pretty moody person. So for me, I'd have to say two, and I've directed them both, but it's King Lear and Hamlet.
Wow.
I think are just, in terms of the philosophy of what it means to be human, what is our relationship perhaps to God, what is our relationship and our responsibility to each other, what does it mean to act and to be responsible for our actions. I think these two plays examine this in such a beautiful, complex, melancholy, and ultimately strangely celebratory way. And there are plays I've directed more than once, and I'll go back to, I find you go back to these plays every 5-10 years of your life, and what's wonderful about them is that they suddenly open up in an entirely new way. The play's never changed, you've changed.
I think of something that Rachel already said. You just mentioned two plays that are, as you point out, dense, complex, long
plays. Yeah, they're
plays.
Long plays. It's a lot
and
of words.
The energy required to do Lear must be overwhelming.
Well, it's why very often when you're going to do Lear, there's always the conversation about who do we cast? Because actually, it's one of those plays where you don't decide to do Lear unless you know who your Lear is. But there has to be this very, very fine balance of someone who is old enough to have the life experience, to play the role, to understand what being in the latter stage of life is, and to be believable to an audience as this ancient king he's described as, but yet still be young enough, athletic enough, vigorous enough, or as Donald Trump would say, have the stamina enough to say all of the words that Lear has to say. And not only all the words, but in the middle of the play, rage against an onstage storm for 12 minutes.
I was just thinking about the storm when you said all that. So you've done Lear.
Right. Yes.
You've done it more than once?
No, only the one time.
So who did you play in Lear?
So I was Goneril.
And remind everybody of...
So Goneril was one of Lear's three daughters, right? And he is dividing the kingdom and and so two of the daughters are very, you know, motivated to get rid of dad and take over.
They're selfish, greedy.
Right. And our Lear, when we did it,
although
Rick
they think they're entirely justified.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Well, because he's, you know, lost his mind and...
And who is Goneril?
Goneril, the middle daughter, and looking very much to...
You know, one of the schemers.
Right, right. Yeah, looking to, advance her position.
What's it like to find yourself on stage in the middle of King Lear on a given night?
Well, when we did it, Austin Pendleton was our Lear, and he had a unique approach to acting, especially Shakespeare, because he... Not with the words, but with his actions and his staging was incredibly improvisational. So he gave me, as an actress, the great gift of having a Lear who was literally, you could not know what he was going to do. He was completely unpredictable, which is what the girls are saying.
And,
you know,
and I directed this production, and it was something that Austin and I talked about really early on, is what if we really explore what mm-hmm. dementia and Alzheimer's might really be about? Mm-hmm. Little did I know, because he's such a great actor, little would I know that meant that every performance, the director's horror, is that he'd be in an entirely different portion of the stage.
You would come on stage.
Putting his back to the audience for two or three passages.
He would normally be down here, and then he would be up there. He would sometimes stand stock still in the middle of the stage. Sometimes he would prowl it. So for me, as the act, you know, as his daughter, who is saying, he's lost his mind, he's unpredictable, he does this, he does that, he's not capable, we are going to take over everything.
There was good reason.
I could be so justified in it. And yet it was wonderful. I mean, some actors could not ride that horse with him. And no matter what he would say or do, it would be their same response. But it was like a great tennis match, because then you would, you know, do that dance with him.
Yeah.
And one performance, because he was always throwing stuff at you, and one performance, he comes in to the scene with Goneril and her husband, and he's coming in, and he's angry, and he's upset, and he comes up, and he comes right up to me, and he grabs my face between his hands and kisses me full on the mouth.
This is Lear kissing
his daughter. For a good 5 seconds,
in
right?
In a performance in like the second or third week.
Yeah.
That...
And so that fuels my husband to do the, you know, and it was able to go. It was a completely different scene. And it, interesting, but, you know, you have to keep playing it because, like, that's never happened before. And, and, you know, a lot of actors, if they did that, you would then have a very serious conversation with them afterwards and say, this is not, but he's an actor I know well, a good friend, and I trust him. And I knew it wasn't about just sneaking a kiss in, but he did right after the show, he comes up, he goes, you know, I wanted to try that, and yeah, it didn't work. So I knew it was never going to happen again.
Did he tell you what he had in mind?
Well, there had been some exploration during rehearsal, if I remember correctly, that he and Reagan had an incestuous relationship.
Another daughter.
Right, yeah. The oldest daughter.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. So he was just taking that one step further to see if maybe, you know, it worked.
Have another one.
Yeah, why not? So, you know, for me as an actress, you know, you have to not forget your line when something untoward happens.
So I asked Rick if he had a favorite Shakespeare, and I recognize it's an unfair question. How do you choose among the 30-plus plays? But let me ask you.
Well, I have to go along with Hamlet because of just the questions it asks and the journey that Hamlet takes.
Have you done Hamlet?
No, Gertrude is on my list, on my short list.
The mother.
That's getting shorter as I get older.
Yeah.
But... I do have to say Hamlet. I also love Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Okay. So you have both been really lovely to agree that you would choose a speech, a soliloquy from Shakespeare to share with us.
This is a piece that every time I hear it, and I've never done it except in the car on the way up. I was reading it out loud to Rick, and he was like saying, well, he was giving me a few directorial points. But every time I've heard it or seen somebody do it, it says to me what I as an actor feel as I sort of am stepping on stage in a Shakespearean role. It's the prologue from Henry V, the chorus, the prologue. And it's about we're putting on a show for you. We've learned these lines. We've worked. But it's a two-way street, folks. You're part of it as well. And in this prologue, you know, he or she, the chorus, is saying this, that and it's about what we have in common, our imaginations.
Henry V, of course, one of the great King plays
Shakespeare. Oh, one of the, yeah.
Were there things textually as you went through it? How do you, you've never done it before, so how do you approach that text?
Well, there was at least one word that I had no idea what it meant.
And what word?
Puissance. Because I don't use it often.
Yeah.
So I had to go in and look it up.
And what does it mean?
It's it means a couple of, it could mean one of two things. Either a competition, a horse competition about them jumping over obstacles, getting over great obstacles. Or it's about prowess and power and ability. So in a way, it means both. So that was one of those words. I was like, okay, I love the word, but what does it mean? Yeah, and also coming into it and just figuring out how to really paint the picture that I see. Because when I read it, I see it. But how do I get it into my voice and body to share that?
Well, that's exactly what poetic text is about, right?
Right?
Poetic dramatic text contains pictures, right? It's about images. And the job of the actor is to figure out how to then place those images using voice and body into the mind of the listener.
Elizabethan stage, when Shakespeare's writing this, there were maybe one or two hand props. There were no scenery.
Maybe a curtain, maybe not a curtain,
yeah,
upstage.
Upstairs, downstairs. That's it.
Maybe
that's
a throne, maybe not a throne.
So it strikes me, Rachel, we're going to let you read this now, okay. But it does strike me that our listeners ought to pay attention to, at the very beginning especially, because you've just told us you're coming on stage to alert the audience they're about to see a performance.
Right.
But enough of me. Rachel Harker, you're going to read the prologue to Henry V.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. A kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, and gentles all, the flat, unraised spirits that have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon. Since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us, ciphers to this great accompt on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. Into a thousand parts divide on man and make imaginary puissance. Think, when we talk of horses, that you see them, printing their proud hooves of the receiving earth, for 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carry them here and there, jumping o'er times, turning the accomplishment of many years into an hourglass, for the which supply, admit me, chorus, to this history, who prologue-like your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge, our play.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for letting me find something fun and new to do spend time with something new. Yeah.
Certainly there are contemporary plays that break the fourth wall in which actors talk to audiences,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Sure.
But in Shakespeare's day, this prologue, the audience and the actors,
They always had a dialogue.
They were always engaged together.
Yeah, there
it
is
was,
no,
okay, we're not going to have a big set, yeah. so you've got to imagine.
There's
I
no
love
fourth
that,
wall in Shakespeare's
Can this
place.
Cockpit yeah. hold the vast fields of France? That's a wonderful line, and it tells yeah. us something about Shakespeare and his audience.
It does. It does. And, you know, you have to keep in mind, not only did was his audience surrounding three sides of the stage, so they were seeing each other besides seeing the actors. If you were really wealthy, you could probably, you know, buy
a seat on stage.
And you could sit on stage during the performance, too. So there's no fourth wall at all. And this is something that a lot of contemporary productions don't ever really grasp. They'll understand, oh, when Hamlet does one of his seven soliloquies, he's talking to the audience.
Yeah.
But then we go into the scene and the actors are just in the scene. No. There's never a fourth wall in Shakespeare. The actor is always conscious that this is an event where the audience is engaged, they're part of the storytelling, and very often in the middle of a scene, the actor still needs to turn around and talk to the audience.
You have selected something you'd like to read. Tell us about what you chose.
Well, this is from a play that I've directed three times.
Which is?
As You Like It.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of my favorite plays. And the reason I've chosen it is that I think it gives a really interesting perspective of the dark side of Shakespeare and his point of view about human nature. So now will come my ham-handed attempt to have the audience hear the speech.
Rick, you're reading the Seven Ages of Man speech from As You Like It, one of the most famous
speeches
in Shakespeare.
By the character of Jaques, who is an older, cynical, somewhat tragic, maybe syphilitic, disease-ridden, melancholy, done-it-all, seen-it-all, outcast lord, who has a very dark view now of his fellow man and of what humans are capable of doing to each other and what we think of as this great life and what it might really be. So imagine that the young man has just run off to get his dying servant to bring him around this campfire where these cold people in exile, these refugees, are in the snow, starving. And Jaques says this, "All the world's a stage. And all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy, with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress's eye, brow. Then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden, and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard a formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big, manly voice, turning again to childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange, eventful history, is second childishness in mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans everything.
Rick Lombardo reading from As You Like It. Rachel Harker, Rick Lombardo, what a joy to have you both here. Thank you so much for not only talking with us, but for sharing very generously your talents. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Rick Lombardo was on his way to New York to begin rehearsals for not one but two off-Broadway plays that will open in early 2017. Rachel Harker continues to work largely in film and television productions. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Our simply sensational senior producer is Jenny Ament. Our intern is James Rising. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.